and then blues all day until 5. Lawn chairs, sun hats, screen and shades will coordinate well with a donation of any amount. The Blues Cruise Car Show benefit at the Eastside Club, Lake Monona, Sunday, July 30th, 10 till 5. This is WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. The 2017 Blues Cruise Car Show and Blues Concert, benefiting Project Home Wisconsin for Veterans, will be at the beautiful Eastside Club on Lake Monona, Sunday, July 30th. For 40-plus years, Project Home Wisconsin in Dane and Greene counties has successfully assisted community military veterans and others with crucial home repair and accessibility solutions. Again, Blues Cruise hosts a family-friendly event with unique cars, trucks, bikes, and maybe a boat. Live hand-picked blues music and food, vendor, and flea market booths. The music begins at 10 a.m. with a special DJ record spin, and then blues all day until 5. Lawn chairs, sun hats, screen and shades will coordinate well with a donation of any amount. The Blues Cruise Car Show benefit at the Eastside Club, Lake Monona, Sunday, July 30th, 10 till 5. This is WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Bernie's Rock Shop, located at 901 East Johnson, and our new shop, Bernie's on Park, at 636 South Park in Madison. We offer handmade silver jewelry as well as unique mineral, crystal, and fossil specimens from around the world. Store hours and more information available at berniesrockshop.com.
From killer heat waves in North America to crumbling ice sheets in Antarctica, this is the Perpetual Notion Machine for Thursday, July 20th, 2017. I'm your host, Will Cushman. Tonight, exactly six months since our climate change denier-in-chief took the oath of office, our focus is again on the very real science of climate change and the threats it poses. We're airing two pre-recorded interviews this evening. Both interviews focus on pretty recent happenings in the field of climate change and climate science. Later on, we'll listen in as my colleague Kai Brito talks with UW-Madison scientist Matthew Lazara about the Delaware-sized hunk of the Antarctic ice sheet that has broken free and is floating in the Atlantic Ocean. Lazara's research groups began tracking Antarctic icebergs from space and placing weather stations on icebergs after a series of major iceberg calving events in 2000. But first, I'm going to talk to UW-Madison Professor of Medical History and Bioethics Rick Keller about recent research that appeared in the journal Science about the forecasted economic and public health consequences of climate change in the United States. I spoke with him at his office on campus. Let's listen in. Okay, cool. So I'm here with Rick Keller in his office on the UW-Madison campus in Bascom Hall. Rick, I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about what you do, your research background, as it relates to climate change and public health and just kind of in general.
Sure. Thanks very much, Will. Most of my research and teaching focuses on the social and historical dimensions of global health, with an increasing focus on the intersection of environmental change and health crisis. I focused mostly on Europe in much of my research, but as far as my teaching goes, I really try to include much of the world.
So I want to talk about a recent study that came out about the potential effects of climate change in the United States. It was mostly focused, I think, on economic impact, impacts of climate change, and kind of the thesis of that research was that the South and the Midwest would probably be hit hardest, and there would actually be some regions in the United States that might actually fare better as a result of climate change. So I know that that study was focused on the economy, but there were some links to public health there. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what we might see in the Midwest, and then kind of more nationally in terms of the economy or public health or whatever with climate change.
Sure. That piece came out in Science, probably 2 weeks ago now. It was written by a group of economists, a team of economists who were essentially looking at economic models of what some of the economic effects of climate change might be in different regions in the United States. Basically, they argue that increased temperatures will effectively be extremely problematic for labor markets and for production, for agricultural production in the American South and potentially in the Midwest as well. There could be a net benefit effect for places like New England. But what they're basically pointing out is that essentially, the poorest areas of the United States will be the hardest hit by climate change economically. Now, that's kind of ironic because, indeed, climate change events like extreme heat waves tend to prey on inequalities that are already existing. So by exacerbating these inequalities, what we'll see is, in a sense, not only increasing economic vulnerability in some of the poorest parts of the country, but increasing health vulnerability as well.
So that increasing health vulnerability will be in large part because of, as you said, heat waves, people not having access to air conditioning, for instance. I guess could we talk a little bit more about other vulnerabilities that will be laid bare by climate change?
Absolutely. So extreme heat really kind of tops the list. As far as weatherborne as far as meteorological disasters go, extreme heat kills really about 10 times all other forms of extreme weather combined. So it's far, far worse than weather phenomena like tornadoes or hurricanes. Of course, you can have an anomaly like Hurricane Katrina, which killed about 1,800 people in the United States. But really, year in, year out, it's extreme heat that's really the most lethal meteorological problem. Other kinds of health vulnerabilities will come from phenomena like vector-borne diseases. As we see increasing temperatures in the American South, we'll see increased habitat for mosquitoes that can carry all kinds of different diseases, not only things like Zika and dengue fever, but indeed malarial mosquitoes will come back to the United States. There have been, in the past decade or so, a handful of cases of domestically transmitted malaria in the United States, in places like Florida and Texas. With warming temperatures, with increased wet weather, we'll probably see a notable uptick in those kinds of crises as well. Indeed, we might also see that kind of problem affecting us here in the upper Midwest. As we have shorter winters, we'll have longer mosquito seasons and longer tick seasons. So it's certainly something to look out for.
Kind of address my next question, which is, sure, yeah, in Florida and Texas, these are definitely things to be concerned about. But how concerned should someone in Madison really be about what climate change is going to do to the local economy or to the local public health system, to themselves?
Well, an important thing to recognize is we use the term climate change for a reason. It's not just increasing temperatures. People haven't really used the term global warming for about a decade and a half now. And the reason for that is that climate change involves not just warming temperatures, but also phenomena like increased wet weather, increased flooding, increased extreme weather. So while warmer weather might produce a net benefit for agriculture in Wisconsin, perhaps, by increasing the growing season, at the same time, those extreme weather phenomena like floods, extreme downpours, can actually wash out crops and make the ground too wet to farm effectively. So I think right now we're looking at serious uncertainty in terms of what climate change will bring for the economy in the upper Midwest. right now we're experiencing a boom in floodwater mosquitoes because of what a wet spring and summer we've had. Thankfully, these are more of a nuisance than a real health risk, more of an annoyance than anything. But of course, some of my colleagues in entomology have just discovered Albus albopictus mosquitoes, which can transmit Zika for the first time in Wisconsin just this past week. So, you know, one has to worry about what the potential effects of a changing and wetter climate, wetter and warmer climate might do for Wisconsin. There may be some net benefit effects economically, but also some pretty frightening uncertain possibilities.
I kind of want to get into a little bit of your expertise, your background. You did quite a bit of research and published a book on the heat wave in Paris.
Yes.
That I think was pretty deadly. Could you talk a little bit more about just your expertise and your background?
Sure. I was in France in the summer of 2003 on an unrelated research project. And the summer of 2003 was an extremely hot one throughout Western and Central Europe. There was a series of weather phenomena known as anticyclones, which are basically these large weather systems that are bound by rotating winds and that shut out all other weather. So they tend to sort of stall out in a given region and sit around for a few weeks at a time. There was one of these that happened in late June, one in mid-July, and another in early August. In Europe in 2003. The one in August was the really dangerous one in France in particular. So this was a system that stayed in place over the entire country, shut out all other weather systems, so there wasn't a cloud in the sky, the sun was just blazing down on the entire country, there was scarcely a breeze to be found, and the temperature went north of 100 degrees Fahrenheit for about 2 weeks on end. This was followed, this weather system basically came in August 1st, 2nd. By the 3rd and 4th of August, there was already an uptick in mortality. So by the end of the month, about 15,000 excess deaths were attributed to this extreme heat in France alone. For the summer of 2003, there were about 70,000 excess deaths that are attributed to extreme heat. That's for June, July, and August for the entire continent. But in France alone, in really just about 3 weeks in August 2003, you see this experience of about 15,000 excess deaths, which makes it the worst natural disaster in all of French history. So I was fascinated by how this can happen in a country that has one of the best public health systems in the world. What I discovered was that basically, as I said earlier, extreme heat tends to prey on social inequalities. So those who were affected tended to be older than the general population. Those over 75 years old constituted about 4/5 of all of the excess deaths nationwide. They tended to be poorer. They tended to be clustered in cities. And so there were a series of social factors that put some populations at increased risk. And those factors included things like social isolation, old age, living in cities, and living in poverty. When all four of those things combined, that made for a pretty deadly cocktail.
I'm not sure if you can speak to this, but is that meteorological phenomenon that created this really horrible situation in France, is that something that is fairly atypical, could be more typical in the future as the climate changes, warms? Like how will climate change really dictate events like that?
Sure. Those kinds of anticyclonic inversions actually happen fairly regularly in Europe in particular. They will happen increasingly. So the predictions are that with the changing climate, we're going to see heat waves of increasing intensity, frequency, and duration. So they will be more intense, they will be hotter, they will be longer lasting, and they will be more frequent in the future. Whether that happens in the United States or not is another question, right? Because we have generally different weather systems from Europe. But indeed, certainly in much of Western and Central Europe, this will be an increasing problem. So cities are being forced to adapt in all kinds of ways. One of the other things that's important to note about heat waves, and extreme heat in particular, is it tends to be a bigger problem, or I should say, historically, it has tended to be a bigger problem in cities we tend to think of as cold places, as opposed to cities we think of as hot places. That's also changing. So, in other words, the most dangerous city in the 2003 heat wave in all of Europe was Paris. It had the highest mortality rate, about three times the normal mortality rate. In the United States, one of the worst heat waves took place in Chicago. And Paris and Chicago are places we normally think of as, cool or cold weather cities. And that's because most warm weather cities tend to be built to withstand extreme heat. They tend to already be adapted. But indeed, as we see increasing social inequality in the United States and in Western Europe, what we're seeing is that some of these hotter places that we would imagine are sort of pre-adapted to extreme heat are actually experiencing increased mortality. So in the Latino community, for example, and in an expanding poor community in the American Southwest, in cities like Phoenix, which are used to 115 degree heat in the summer, we're seeing increased mortality in some of those communities as a function not really necessarily of dramatically increasing temperatures, but as a combination of those increasing temperatures and increasing inequality and an inability economically to adapt to that kind of extreme heat.
Well, Rick, I don't really have any other questions for you. Thanks a lot for joining us, and appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much for the invitation to talk.
Let's move on now to Antarctica. Here's my colleague Kai Brito talking with Matthew Lazara, who is the head of the UW-Madison-based Antarctic Meteorological Research Center and Antarctic Automatic Weather Station Program.
I'm Kai Brito, and you're listening to a special edition report on Perpetual Notion Machine. Last week, a massive iceberg as large as Delaware broke off the Antarctic Peninsula. The breakoff of the roughly trillion metric ton iceberg is one of the largest in history, and could have devastating future effects for the climate. I'll be speaking with Dr. Matthew Lazara to understand just what this ice breakoff means for Antarctica. Matthew Lazara is faculty at Madison Area Technical College and a research meteorologist at the Antarctic Meteorological Research Center at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He studies weather and climate events that occur in the Antarctic region. Thank you for joining us today, Matthew.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
That's great. And before we begin, I wanted to place the Larsen Ice Shelf on the map for our listeners. The ice shelf is located in the northeast coast of the Antarctic Peninsula, along the Weddell Sea, just below the southernmost tip of the South American continent. So Matthew, just to start off, can you describe the general geography and climate conditions that exist around the Larsen Ice Shelf?
Sure. So this part of the Antarctic, this, as you mentioned, it's the peninsula, so it kind of sticks a bit further north than most of the Antarctic continent. And so this particular ice shelf is located between the Weddell Sea, which is one of the more ice, sea ice covered oceans in close to the Antarctic, and along the peninsula is a spine of transantarctic mountains. They're Rocky Mountain tall, to give you an idea of how tall they are, and so they have lots of glaciers on them. These glaciers actually then flow down onto the ice shelf where the iceberg calving has taken place.
And what sort of temperature conditions exist around there? If you could give me a range, perhaps?
Oh, sure. So temperatures here in the peninsula during their austral summer can be quite warm. In fact, they're some of the warmest temperatures in the Antarctic we've ever had have occurred here, not quite where the ice shelf calving took place, but a bit further north. You can imagine it can get warm into the 50-degree, maybe even close to 60-degree range, which is amazing. Those are the records that have ever occurred since we've been there. However, it can also get quite cold. You're talking about an area that can get temperatures down into the minus 20s and the minus 30s or even colder for temperatures for this particular region. It gets much colder when you get further into the continent where you can get temperatures there. For example, I've had my weather stations that we've installed on the continent get down to 100 below, or we've had some this past winter that have gotten down to 105 or 108 below Fahrenheit.
Okay, that's good to know. What sort of factors can contribute to ice calving or the natural breakoffs in the Antarctic region?
So for these ice shelves, they're not just one static slab of ice. They have all these crevasses and rifts in them. And so for this particular Larsen C ice shelf, the calving has been actually going on for quite some time. The original cracks, the original seam that became where the iceberg rifted away has been watched for the last couple of decades and became very prominent about 7 or 8 years ago. And so what happens is as the glaciers are flowing off those tall mountains down onto the ice shelf, these various rifts and breaks and so forth, these crevasses end up lining up at some point, and they become part of where you get these icebergs to form. And this, of course, isn't your traditional iceberg. It's a tabular iceberg. It's huge. And so when you get them to then line up, those become the spots that become the actual calving points where this large iceberg will then calve away from the ice shelf.
And what sort of factors might be responsible for that, natural or otherwise?
Yeah, and that's a great question. I'm glad you asked, because for ice shelves to maintain themselves, if you want to think of it as an equilibrium thing, they have to calve, because they would continue to grow out into the ocean.
Exactly.
And so they will eventually calve off an iceberg. And of course, we've only had satellites around for less than 60 years. And so these kinds of calving events, we believe, occur on an order of maybe every 50 to 100 years to maintain themselves. Ice doesn't move very quickly, so this is a very slow process. So the calving that's taken place here may be just a part of the natural process that we're seeing, getting a chance to witness, because we do have the opportunity to witness it via satellite observations. But what it does implicate now is that, gee, since we've had this calving and we are in a world that we're a little more vulnerable with warming, will we see more calving events take place, continuing to reduce the extent and the amount of the Larsen C ice shelf, and will that cause the glaciers, which are further upstream of that, to then accelerate and add more ice and therefore more water content to the ocean? So that's the climate change part is the part that's less clear.
Yes, I've actually seen that scientists are hesitant, even almost, to say that the Larsen ice breakoff event was due to climate change. What is the chance that this event could be due to natural causes?
Yeah, I suspect it really is, that this event is probably more likely natural, but it puts us in a more vulnerable position where now change could now have implications. In a world where we wouldn't have that happening, this is what should be taking place. About 15, 16, 17 years ago, we had some very large calvings of some of the largest icebergs ever witnessed by a satellite, calve off of the Ross Ice Shelf and the Ronny Ice Shelf. And those, once again, were also believed to be non-climate change related, because those ice shelves have been growing and growing out into the Southern Ocean for so long. They were due to calve off. And so that may be the case here as well. But the other parts of the Larsen Ice Shelf, the Larsen A and the Larsen B in particular, their collapse in Larsen B, when it collapsed in the early 2000s, that was a more catastrophic one. It didn't calve off a big tabular iceberg. It looked like someone had taken a piece of glass and had shattered on the ground, lots and lots and lots of pieces.
Yeah, it actually occurred over 3 weeks, didn't it?
Yes, very short amount of time. You went from having an ice shelf in existence, I think it was like this 3 to 5 week time frame, when satellite observations were catching they could see some of the melt pools on the top, but what it was the warm water in the ocean. The oceans, of course, have warmed a little, and they worked their way underneath that ice shelf, and they had been eroding it from the underneath, and they caused a catastrophic collapse from the underneath where the ice, which was very orderly, kind of like there was lots and lots of rifts in that shelf, and so the ice ended up looking probably more like a set of rectangular stacked pieces of ice that were all up on edge, and so that when that water, warm water, got underneath, it actually then forced them to all kind of fall over like dominoes, and so it just collapsed very catastrophically. goes into you know, an area that was, I think it was the size of Rhode Island. It was a huge space that just immediately was gone and now is open ocean. Those kinds of things are, that's a more change-related situation, not one that was expected due to that ice shelf continuing to, say, grow out into the Southern Ocean and get larger than it had ever been during any time that we've been keeping an eye, you know, or monitoring these parts of the Antarctic continent.
What a graphic depiction you gave us of what it was like for that ice shelf to break off. And as you had mentioned earlier, the Larsen A shelf collapsed in 1995, Larsen B in 2002. Now we have Larsen C in 2017. This has all occurred in just over two decades. What is the likelihood of the entire shelf disappearing from the Antarctic continent?
Yeah, so that's the interesting question. We don't know. Right now, the rest of the actual shelf is still intact, and it's going to be of great interest to watch. In fact, the folks who monitor these very large icebergs, the National Ice Center, they actually name the icebergs. They have a naming system. This particular iceberg that's calved off is known as A68. They'll be obviously keeping on top, as will a lot of scientists such as myself, to monitor and see what will happen. Will we notice more calving coming up in the next several years? And, of course, then we'll then begin to become suspicious of that. Even though this specific event may not be a climate change-related one, will additional calvings, if they happen more frequently and we start to see acceleration of, say, the glaciers in the area start to add ice down into the Weddell Sea, that would be then now a subject of turning it from something that's a natural event into one more related to climate change.
Yeah, and what sorts of dangers do these ice breakoffs pose for people? So I've heard some people argue that since they're not nearby, it wouldn't really matter to them. And this iceberg that recently came off is estimated to only raise sea level by 0.1 millimeters, I've read.
Right. You know, ice shelves are interesting. They're a lot like your ice cube that you would put in a glass of water, a floating ice cube. They've displaced the same amount of water that the ice would be if it would turn from ice into liquid water. So they contribute very little to sea level rise. So that is the interesting thing in that regard. And in, with regards to the iceberg being an obstacle, say, to interfere with shipping, as it is right now, the iceberg is kind of like a half-parked, parallel-parked car. It's kind of got to get out of this parking spot. And it's currently, at the moment, going a little bit forward, a little bit back. And we'll see if it actually breaks off a couple of other smaller icebergs in the process of doing that before it actually gets out into the Weddell Sea and then gets into the ocean currents that may start to take it north. Could it interfere with, you know, say, shipping? Perhaps, but nothing that would be very dramatic because it's well established, well documented. We're monitoring it, so folks will be aware of it. So yeah, in this regard, ice shelves themselves don't contribute to the sea level rise issue. What is interesting is that if we did see more of those glaciers further up that feed the Larsen ice shelf, which those glaciers are on land. That ice were to then slowly start to come down and then add, you know, to the area and get into the Weddell Sea, that will indeed now start to increase sea level. This is a smaller portion of the Antarctic continent, but it would be the beginning of actually having that actual contribution.
I see. And for our final question, what sorts of trends or changes will we see in Antarctic geology and climate in the next 5 to 10 years, maybe?
Well, that's a good question. You know, the climate standpoint, we're now just beginning to really have a good sense of the climate of the continent. For many years, since the 1950s, when the International Geophysical Year, there was great effort to systemically monitor, observe the continent. But we did it mostly on the coasts. We didn't do that much of it in the inland areas. Weather stations, the automatic kind that my group work with at the university, and I do a little bit now at the college, we're getting these stations out there that my predecessor started in the 1980s when the first successful year-round running automatic weather stations were installed. we're now been doing that for, it's roughly 30 years. And so that's a magical number, if you will, in the world of climate, because now you can do, take all those weather observations, and they can now become what turns into climatology. So we can now get a sense of what should be the average temperatures for this part of the world, what should be the average weather conditions, and having a sense of what we should see for highs and lows. As the years now will go by going forward, we're going to get a sense of, well, now it's colder than normal. Well, gee, now we're noticing